Welcome to the podcast Lege om livet, or Doctors on Life, as it's called in English. My name is Annette Raglan. I'm a medical doctor, and my intention with this podcast is to make useful, fun, and important knowledge about body health and mind easily accessible to us all. Today, I have Charlotte Salter as my guest. Welcome, Charlotte.
Hi.
She is a trained doctor in the UK and has also completed her specialization in general practice. She has worked as a GP in the military and at the NHS, National Health Service, in the UK. In 2020, she moved to Norway with her family and completed the International Board of Lifestyle Medicine Diploma in 2022, and since then became an associate member of the European Lifestyle Medicine Council and have co-founded the Norske Forening for Livsstilsmedisin. What is that called in English?
That would translate to the Norwegian Society of Lifestyle Medicine.
Yeah, that's such a great and important job. She is currently working as head of lifestyle medicine at Kry, where she is passionate about using lifestyle medicine to help improve her patients' well-being and quality of life. Welcome, Charlotte Salter.
Hi. This is so exciting.
I'm so happy to have you here. And you work right across the street,
I heard. Yeah, it's not far. It's just in Vika.
Yeah. So you moved to Norway 4 years ago?
Yeah, almost. So it was summer 2020. I wouldn't recommend moving country in the middle of a pandemic or Brexit.
Oh, no, really?
It was quite hard.
Oh, yeah, that must have been really hard because it was impossible to get to know new people then.
Yeah, it was a challenge. But
where did you start to work then? Right at Kry, or?
No, I've had an interesting journey. First of all, I had to learn Norwegian.
Yeah.
So I know we're speaking English now, but I can prate litt norsk.
Yeah, your Norwegian is great.
Oh, thank you.
Last time we met, we talked in Norwegian probably half of the time.
Yeah, thanks. And I actually started working. My first job was at a Faber polyclinic in Skien. So helping people who thought they had COVID symptoms and who had a fever and couldn't go to see their fastlege, and they would come and see me instead.
Oh, so you met like 20 corona patients a day.
Yeah, in full utstyr.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was pretty intense, but it was a really great way to practice my Norwegian because I get to ask the same questions every day. Like, har du feber? Hoste du? And a really great way to practice, but that was kind of the stepping stone to then getting a more normal job.
Yeah. And you live in Hostlum. We just talked about it. You've found a really great society there. And we're going to talk about relationships later in this episode. But today we're going to talk about lifestyle medicine, first of all. Yeah. What is lifestyle medicine?
Yeah, so there isn't just one definition. And I think the definition really depends on your view of it or which country you're from. But what I would suggest lifestyle medicine is, it's a relatively new evidence-based field of medicine, and we're focusing on lifestyle habits that lead to the causes of many chronic diseases. And lifestyle medicine aims to help patients and support them to make positive behavior change so that we can prevent, reverse, and treat lifestyle-related diseases. It's a bit of a dry.
That's music.
Definition.
That's music in my ears.
But can I give it a bit of context, a little sort of explain it a bit more?
Absolutely.
So we know that at the moment around the globe, there's about 80% of disease is caused by a lifestyle-related illness. Hmm. And what I mean by that, to give that a bit more information as well, is so what is a lifestyle-related disease? A fancy word for it in English, we would call it a non-communicable disease. This is something that isn't infectious. It's not a virus or a bacteria that's infected somebody, but it is something that we are ill with that probably has an element from the way that we're living. Hmm. So we call it different words, like chronic disease, or lifestyle related. And to bring it a little bit more home, to Norway, if we look at the top five causes of death in Norway, all five of them are lifestyle related. shall I run you through?
Yeah.
So number one is dementia. We know that a lot of dementia is related to lifestyle. Heart disease, and in there would be high blood pressure and cholesterol. Stroke. Certain types of cancer, including bowel cancer, and then chronic obstructive lung disease. So these are the top five reasons that people are dying in Norway. And I would say that all of these, and I think you would agree with me, are lifestyle related in some way. So when we're talking about these lifestyle diseases, we know, and this is not just me sat here, but this is like the WHO and the CDC and big think tanks around the world, that all of these lifestyle-related diseases have at least three factors in common, and that is unhealthy diet, physical inactivity, and smoking.
Hmm.
So if we look at what conventional medicine has been doing the last 50, 60, 70 years, is that we wait until a patient gets sick, they have a symptom, they come to the doctor, and then we give them some medication or an operation to help them feel better.
Hmm.
What lifestyle medicine is trying to do is trying to get to the root cause and say, why are you getting sick, and can we prevent this?
Hmm.
So there's an analogy that I've sort of borrowed from somebody that I thought was a good way to explain it. So if you had a kitchen sink and the tap is on and the tap is flowing really fast and there's water in the sink, but it's so much water that it's spilling over the side and it's coming onto the floor. If we imagine that water is illness and the body is the sink, and we can tolerate quite a lot. A lot of it can go down the drain, but the bit that's spilling over, those are the symptoms.
Yeah.
And as doctors in conventional medicine, we are mopping up the floor. We're saying, okay, this is spilling over, you're feeling unwell, you've got all these symptoms, it's on the floor, we're going to mop it up, and we can give you medications, we can have an operation. But what lifestyle medicine is trying to do is we're trying to turn off the tap, trying to reduce this flow of water so that the body can cope with it and drain on its own. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. And in health service in Norway and the UK and so many countries are great at mopping up the floor. Like, if I have an illness, I want to get help from a medical doctor here in Norway in the healthcare. But there are so many people that get illnesses that they probably or maybe would not get if they also had someone in the healthcare system that help them stop
the tap. Yeah, no, definitely. And there's a phrase that goes around my head all the time that we don't in Norway or England or a lot of countries have a healthcare system. We have a sickness system.
Yeah.
So we wait for people to get sick and then we help them. And actually what I think that we need more of is people teaching society, everybody, and how to be healthy.
Yeah. I wrote an article about this with my colleagues Torkil Færø and Gunnil Melleby, and we published it at NRK. And we got so many good feedback on it, but there was more than I thought there would be from the medical society, saying that we don't want to. We have so much on our plate from before, and I understand that because medical doctors, nurses, biochemists, like everyone that's working in the healthcare system, they are swamped. There's so much to do because the sink or the tap has been going on full speed for so long that we are seeing a rise in so many diseases, and children are also affected by diseases that we probably got in later years before. So we have so much on our plate from before, and that if we also get lifestyle medicine on our plate, we don't have time for it. But what I was actually trying to say in that article is that it's not about the people working in the healthcare system. The people working in the healthcare system is today's heroes. Like, they are working so hard, but we need to have someone there that can help them with turning off that tap. So maybe we that work in the medical care can have time to do what we're trained to do.
Yeah, I think as doctors, this isn't something that we can just lead and change everything. We need policymakers and people higher up in public health to make it easier for everybody.
Exactly.
And to make the healthy choices easier and the first choice to make. I mean, this isn't a blame game. This isn't a, oh, you've been living an unhealthy life and that's why you're sick.
Mm.
But we also need to acknowledge the vast amounts of data and research that show that by living, by changing our lifestyle habits, and it doesn't have to be drastically, but by making some small changes, we can be healthier.
Yeah.
And it's very confusing. You know, if it's easier to drive to work than it is to cycle to work, well, that's a no-brainer.
Hmm.
If it's safer, if you feel like you're going to get knocked off your bicycle, then you're going to drive.
Hmm.
If when you go into a shop and you're hungry, the first thing you see is something that's ultra-processed and in a packet, and that's cheaper than buying the fresh fruit, or you can't even find the fresh fruit,
hmm.
you're not going to make the right decision.
Hmm.
But what I think is really important about lifestyle medicine is that this should be something that is in the foundation of every person in the health service. It should be in their training so that we all have a really good understanding of how we can use bits of it to inform our practice. You know, I'm not saying that every GP is going to suddenly drastically change what they're doing day to day, but if you manage to have one or two good conversations with somebody who's at the start of their journey, maybe with depression or with problems with their cholesterol or high blood pressure, and we actually give them the tools that they need to change and remind them that it is really important to change their lifestyle, then we will have helped, as well as the politicians changing and making things better in like from a higher top-down way.
Yeah, exactly. To manage this, we have to cooperate. We have to cooperate with so many people in society that do different things. What you're just mentioning is like, how can we make it easier for us all to make good choices? Because it's so hard to make a good choice. Like, I was on winter vacation last week, and I didn't have time to, because we were suddenly late for the train back home, and I didn't have enough time to make the food for my kids.
Pet lunch.
Yeah. Mm. And I always do that, but suddenly I didn't have time. And what they serve on the train is like, I couldn't find anything that I could give to my children that was not unhealthy. So they get unhealthy food. And if there was only just one choice, that so many more people would take that one choice because it was available, but we have to make it available.
Mm. And it's supply and demand, isn't it? And if people aren't demanding a good, healthy choice because they don't realise that how important it is for their health, that's also going to affect what happens in the market.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I say that knowledge is the best medicine, because if I have the knowledge, and I've gotten more and more knowledge about this, so it's easier for me to make those choices. But before, it was hard because I knew that it was good for me to do that and that and that, but I didn't know why. Now that I know why, it's so much easier, because I can see that, okay, if I eat a lot of chocolate 10 o'clock in the evening, I can see that that affects my sleep. And I don't have time for that to affect my sleep because I have a lot of meetings every day. So it's easier for me to just skip that chocolate in the evening. So there's just some like small changes that can improve life quality so much.
Yeah, definitely.
But what are the pillars of lifestyle medicine?
Yes, so there are six pillars, and in no particular order. We have healthy eating, physical activity, sleep, mental well-being, positive social relations, and minimizing harmful substances / behaviors.
Can we go through them?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
How do they affect us? And what I think is so interesting with all those pillars is that they're interconnected.
Yeah, it's really hard to talk about one without it talking about the others.
Yeah, because they affect each other.
Yeah, definitely.
which I love because it makes it so much easier than if I know that I prioritize my sleep. I know that it probably will help my gut microbiome. Yeah. It will help my how I work out the next day, or if I'm with my kids, I'll get it. It's better. It's easier for me to have healthy relationships. Like it affects every step of those pillars.
Yeah, definitely. And I think with lifestyle medicine, it is looking at that holistic approach. And that's why it's so fun to work with as well.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And what I love about it is that it's evidence-based.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we have the science backing this up.
Yeah.
So it's an integrated part of medicine, which is a very important part. And now we also have studies and the science behind backing this up and making it easier for us to talk about.
Mm.
Because our mothers and our great-grandmothers and our great-great-grandmothers knew how important food was.
Yeah.
But the science behind it hasn't been... It's been hard to talk about because there has been... Yeah, you know.
It is really confusing as well because we get so much information from social media or we get information from advertising. And so, you know, you were talking to one of your previous guests about ultra-processed food, and when there's a happy cartoon on some children's food saying that it's got fruit inside, we believe that that's healthy, but
yeah,
that's not necessarily always the case, that it's actually a good, healthy choice.
Mm.
So it's a jungle sometimes.
And it's making it so hard for us.
Yeah. But what is, I think sometimes when I'm talking about lifestyle medicine to people, they're like, oh, so everything you're mentioning is stuff we already know about. I'm like, yeah, this isn't new necessarily. But what I think is really important is that we've now got the evidence to prove that it works.
Yeah.
Can I give you an example?
Yes, please.
So when I first got interested in lifestyle medicine, I was working in the military in England, and a guy came in for a checkup, and he would put on a bit of weight, a bit of a stressful job, kind of a very normal chat with somebody who's just over 40, took some blood tests, and he had high cholesterol.
Hmm.
And so I was on my own in my office, like looking up, and I was quite a new doctor, so I was like looking at the guidelines really closely, like what am I going to talk to this guy about? And the first step in the cholesterol guidelines, which is the same in Norway, is lifestyle help, lifestyle intervention, change the lifestyle. But that's all it says. It doesn't give you any examples of how to do it or what to say. It doesn't tell me what to do. But I was like, yes, I am quite a fit doctor. I'll be able to talk to him about this. And the second after that is to start a medication, right, to help reduce cholesterol. So the patient comes back in and I say, you know, I'm sorry, I've got some bad news. Your cholesterol's starting to go up. But the good news is that if you lose some weight and we do some lifestyle changes, I think we'll be able to lower this cholesterol.
Mm.
And he's like, oh, okay. Is there anything else? I thought, well, if that doesn't work, then we can look at a medication. He says, yes, I've heard this medication is really effective. I'd like to start medication.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, but I want to talk about lifestyle. He's like, go on then. And then I had nothing to say because I didn't know how to effectively tell him to exercise or what he should be eating to have a good diet. No one had ever taught me. It's not what was covered in general practice training or at medical school, really, not practical, helpful advice. Now, if I had that same patient, I'd be able to say, yes, you know, you can take this medication that will lower your cholesterol, but you might get some side effects, and you it might not help you, in fact, because we know that we give, for every 30 people that we give a cholesterol-reducing medication, we're only expecting to save one person from a heart attack. So those other 29 people who are getting the medication, we're just playing a numbers game. But if I'd had the information at the tip of my tongue to talk about, okay, I'd like you to try and get the minimum recommended physical movement in your day, in your week, and I talked to him in an effective way of how he could do that.
Mm.
And I said, I want you to add more fruit and vegetables, fiber, because we know that helps with your cholesterol. And I want to perhaps focus on his sleep and say, let's prioritize getting 8 hours of sleep a night. Not only would he reduce his cholesterol, but he would also probably reduce his risk of getting bowel cancer. He'd probably reduce his risk of getting heart disease in other ways because he's exercising. And he probably would be less stressed, and, you know, it'd affect his whole life rather than just taking one medication.
Yeah, exactly.
But I didn't have that information then. Mm. So then I had to go and learn it.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And giving a medication for one symptom, it will not give the medication for all the other symptoms that probably will pop up if you continue the lifestyle that gave you that symptom. Yeah. So there's something behind it that we have to look at as well.
Yeah. Looking at the root causes.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
So we have the pillars.
Yeah, sorry.
So there was sleep.
There was sleep, yes. So if we could start with sleep. Yeah. I've written some stuff down because I thought for each pillar we could look at why it's so important, and then also like perhaps just a little bit of how we can, like from a lifestyle medicine perspective.
Yes, I love this. I love talking about this.
So we'll start with sleep. So why it's important, not just because actually doctors are quite good at talking about sleep, because people come to, especially to their fossil egg or to the GP, and say, I can't get to sleep, or I keep waking up in the middle of the night. Yeah. And so sometimes we are quite good. That's something we are quite good at talking about. But what lifestyle medicine really focuses on is prioritizing it.
Okay. Yeah.
Because we are in direct competition with all the major streaming services to just keep watching the next episode, mm. or work a little bit more or do something else in your evening rather than prioritizing 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Mm. But we know that sleep is really, really important to help support your immune system. It helps repair and restore your body. And if you are having less than 7 hours sleep a night, you're more at risk to be obese, to get diabetes, to have mental health problems, to have memory and cognitive function problems, high blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease, or heart disease. Mm. So when I'm talking to patients and they're saying, I just don't have time, I think what I try and argue is, really? Because I don't think you're going to have time to have diabetes.
Yeah.
Either. And this is something that's really important.
Yeah.
So if I had to give us a few top tips for sleep.
Yeah.
Is that okay? So I'd say maintain a sleep pattern. So trying to get more or less the same pattern you have in the week that you have at the weekend is really important. And we've all heard of jet lag, but this actually is something that we called social jet lag that we tend to give ourselves when we stay up late and then go and then get up late. We are giving ourselves a form of jet lag, but it's mostly for a social reason.
Yeah.
So then every Monday and Tuesday, it's even harder to get up, even harder to get going.
Yeah.
Because of the weekend. Avoid caffeine after 2 p.m. Hmm. Norwegians love their coffee.
Yeah, they do. And like I get surprised how. Like I was in winter vacation at Voss at my grandmother, and she was like, but Anette, does coffee really affect my sleep? I can't believe it. But now we have the science backing this up.
We have the science, and I would say that a lot of people say to me, but I fall asleep. And I'd say, yes, you fall asleep, but the quality of your sleep is probably not as good as it would be if you switch to decaf or having tea or something else.
Yeah, you would feel much more refreshed.
Yes.
In the morning if you dropped the coffee. So I get that a lot as well. But I fall asleep, so what's the point? But the quality is affected.
Yeah, so it's really important. Mm. And then other really important parts for sleep hygiene would be to get enough natural daylight. Sometimes a bit tricky in Norway
yeah.
in the winter.
But I have some patients that have had a huge effect of like better sleep by buying the, what do you call those in English?
It's like a light lamp.
Yeah. It really helps them during the winter months.
Yeah.
And it's so important that they get the daylight before 11 in the morning.
So getting exposed to that light early in the morning will help set your routine and then make you want to go to bed at the right time as well in the evening.
Yeah.
So it is really important.
And even affect the sleep quality. So I thought it was so interesting to learn that something I did in the morning affects the sleep at night. Like, how could that be? But now I've seen the science behind it, and it has huge positive ramifications if you do it.
Yeah, I think we all feel better when we've had a good night's sleep. You know, we all know that that helps. Yeah. But actually to start putting the data and saying sleep affects your microbiome, sleep affects your immune system, it affects your risk of getting cancer. Mm. I also work as a bedriftsläge at Kri. And so when people are working night shifts, we know now that women are more chance of getting breast cancer when they work night shifts, and that's because of the sleep deprivation.
Mm.
Also getting diabetes. So I think now we have this knowledge, we really need to be telling people very loud and clearly, it's not okay to deprioritize sleep just because you don't fancy sleeping or you think it's boring. It's a really important part of your life that's going to keep you healthy.
Yeah, it is.
Which pillar do you want to go to next?
Oh, but I my listeners know that I love to talk about sleep.
Oh, yeah.
And I've had some sleep courses, and I just want to say that for some people, it's really, really hard sleeping. It's hard to get to sleep, or they wake up in the middle of the night, or they wake up really early in the morning and they can't fall asleep again. So by looking at those other pillars first, you might be able to again sleep well, and we'll go through them. But for some people, we have to find the root cause. What's the root cause of your sleep problems? And maybe it's not the sleep in itself, maybe it's stress.
Yeah,
we know that cortisol has a huge impact on our sleep. Maybe it's the food. Maybe we know that a lot of people with IBS have problems with sleep.
And vice versa. It's really important to have a rest period after you've eaten. So I think the research is having 2 to 3 hours stopping eating before you want to sleep. So you get to digest all your food. So you're not trying to do two things at once.
Exactly.
That's really important.
Exactly. So sometimes starting with another pillar will help you a ton with that pillar. Yeah. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Okay, what's the next pillar?
Shall we go to mental well-being?
Yes.
Okay. So why is it important? 20% of people in Norway will suffer at some point over a year's period with mental health problems.
Hmm.
And we know that mental health affects physical health, but also physical health affects mental health.
Yeah.
And they did some research in England a few years ago, the King's Fund Trust, looking at what is the overlap. And they reckon it's 30%. So 30% of people who have a mental health problem also have a physical health problem. And, just purely why we should be looking at this more, they also worked out that the negative effects of mental health on a physical health problem is costing the NHS £8 billion a year.
Hmm.
So if we're just looking purely at a numbers game, it's really important that we tackle this and take it seriously and realize that this isn't just, oh, people have mental health problems and people are sick with diabetes or cancer or other things. They're completely interconnected and they affect each other.
Yeah, exactly. And we finally come there that we understand that we are one unit and our brain is a part of the system here. So mental health is also physical health.
Yeah, definitely. So ways that we can, that the lifestyle medicine approaches to helping with mental well-being is to look at stress management. So identifying stresses in your life and being aware of them and then finding effective, healthy ways to manage that.
Mm.
And it's different for everyone. We could do a whole podcast just on that. So, But other things that really help our well-being is having a purpose in life and feeling like we have a reason to get up in the morning, things to be doing in the day, people that you're helping, people that are going to be helping you. And also lifestyle medicine is very, very, very concerned with using nature as a way to improve our health and being outside in nature. And I actually think Norway is pretty good at this already. There's a lot of people who want to take more walks in the evening and really love to embed that into their daily life, but sometimes deprioritize it, thinking that the stress in their life will be better fixed spending time on it, and then you're not going out and you're not getting that trip, that walk.
Yeah.
But actually, we know that's a really good way to de-stress and also improve our mental health. So it's always trying to find that balance.
Yeah.
But that's just one way. We also I'm sure you've looked at the research recently, the SMILES
trial
yeah. and the Healthy Med, looking at Mediterranean diet and how that affects mental health. So I think that's a really important factor that we can be talking to our patients about. And it's actually what I find most people come back to me and say when they eat more vegetables and a colourful rainbow of diet and adding in fish and taking away the ultra-processed food, so more alike to a Mediterranean diet, how it affects their mental health. And they're always surprised, and it just makes me smile because I'm just so pleased that they're getting some positive results.
Yeah, isn't that super interesting that the food you eat can affect how you feel?
Yeah.
Like, it has a direct effect, and we know that now. And I was talking with our næringsfysiolog, what nutritionist in Norway, Inge Lindseth, about this. We talked about autoimmune diseases and hypothyroidism. And we were talking about, like, if we eat, let's say, a carrot, that carrot has so many different chemical compounds and so many that it has bacteria on the, it has there's so much like small interplays in one carrot. I don't know how to say it in English, but one carrot can do so much for you versus if you eat, let's say, an ultra processed carrot for some kind of processed type, it will have lost so much of the good stuff in it that we can't emphasize how important this is, because we don't know. We have some knowledge, but there's so much we don't know yet about how food communicates with us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if we move on to healthy eating as one of the pillars, I actually think I probably talk about healthy eating more than the others, because I think it, even though I said one isn't more important than the others with these pillars, I do think a lot of things start with food.
Yeah.
And it is often a basis. And also I think it almost acts as medicine.
Yeah.
So what we put in our mouths is really, really important. And as I said at the beginning, when we're looking at different chronic diseases and lifestyle related diseases, we know that three factors are related to all of them, and that one of them was unhealthy diet.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can explain how important diet is.
No.
I don't have the words. And as you said, we don't have all the research yet because we don't know what we're looking for sometimes. But the last 20 years looking at the microbiome is starting to show some light on actually how important it is. If you think 70% of your immune system lives in your tummy, and it's surrounded by a microbiome, we want to give it the best environment possible. Mm. So I love talking about food, and and I do that a lot with my patients. And I think if I was to say two things that, well, the lifestyle medicine approach is to avoid ultra-processed foods as much as possible. Mm. And then the other is to have a whole food plant-based diet. And so that doesn't mean you can't eat meat or you have to be vegetarian or vegan, but it's just saying at the basis of what you're eating, let's think about vegetables and fruit and plants in their whole form. So if your grandma knew what it was and she would recognize that vegetable or fruit or whatever, then that's a good sign that that's what we're meant to be eating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had Chris von Tulken at the podcast a month ago or so, and he was talking about how, because it's so much more difficult taking healthy food choices now than before, because we're confused, because like just recently I was helping a father and a child with something, and I just walked into the kitchen and I saw that on the label of the cereal that he gives his child, it was like, I think it was like a Snickers cereal or something. It was chocolate in it. Oh. But it says on the label, and this father loves his child, and he would do anything for her. But he read the label as, okay, this is 40% fiber. This must be good. So the labels actually affect our choices, because we want the best for our children and we want the best for ourselves. But if we get tricked to think that this is healthy because it's 40% fiber, we are doing something to society that is very serious, because the ramifications of this we are now seeing. We're seeing that so many diseases are increasing in incidence, and our children are suffering from it. So it's harder, Charlotte, to eat healthier now than it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago.
Yeah, we were almost boggled by choice.
Yeah.
And then unfortunately, the healthy choices are being hidden. And yeah, they're not front of mind. And it's like, oh, but it's easier to grab something that's in a plastic packet. Or it's, oh, this says extra protein, extra fiber,
exactly.
Or less sugar, no sugar.
Yeah.
But I think my advice that I give to my patients is that if it's telling you something like that, it's probably ultra processed and not very good for you.
And that's a very easy way to think about it. But then we have to know, why shouldn't we eat ultra processed food?
Yeah. I mean, you've had a whole nother podcast about this.
Yeah, yeah.
but we know that people, and they've done large scale studies, so 70,000 people looking at what happens when people are eating large amounts of ultra processed food, and people tend to get more chronic diseases, these lifestyle related diseases. People are getting overweight. They are getting heart disease, cancer. They're just mental health problems. Yeah. Just to mention a few. Mm. I think with mental health, I think it was in Australia they did the study, and when people start to eat over 30% of their normal diet as ultra processed, that's when they started to get symptoms.
Oh wow!
And that's crazy when you think that on average, especially children are eating 50 to 60% ultra processed in Norway.
Yeah.
It's something that I know that my friends and family maybe get a bit fed up of me talking about. But and then my colleagues at work, when I'm like raising my eyebrows at lunchtime. but it is really important. And this is something that as a GP or somebody in the Norwegian health system could be saying, actually, you know what? I have read the evidence behind this. You know what, to help you with your depression, why don't you just try cutting out some of the ultra processed and eating more of the natural foods and giving them the great examples and some framework to go by. And that could be the one thing that they do that day, but actually is going to have a massive effect and far more rewarding as a doctor to do that than to raise their medication, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And I have so many stories from my patients getting better or getting healthy, friske, by changing their diets from mental health illnesses. And I can't emphasize the importance of this, because it is very, very difficult to change your eating habits when you are feeling so bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
But with the support from someone that cares about you, like a medical doctor or a friend that knows the importance of healthy eating, you can have a huge positive impact on that person, and that person will never forget it and teach other people about this. So it's not something like that we svevende. It's not something we have the science to back this up now.
Yeah,
and I have so many stories that I could tell from people getting a good life after changing their diet.
Yeah.
So how the diet affects our health is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was talking about ultra-processed food on Debatten last year, and a lot of the fallback was like, you can't go scaring patients. You can't scare them about what they're not allowed to eat. And it really made me think about it, and I actually wrote an article in Dagens Medicine about it. Talking about, is it really scaring patients to give them good medical advice? Like, as doctors, we talk about not smoking or reducing our alcohol, and we have good evidence to back it up. And I don't think patients come out of the doctor's office thinking, oh my goodness, I'm scared about what the doctor's told me. But they may say words like, I feel better informed, or okay, at least now I have a choice.
Yeah.
And I think the same should apply to ultra-processed food. I think that all doctors, because it affects every part of our health, should have an understanding and help the patients understand the information that is out there, the research and the data, because then the patients can make that decision. And as Chris Van Tulleken said, he's not saying ban all ultra-processed foods. He's not saying shut down the factories. But if you have a health problem and you believe that maybe this is a one way to help, having some information from your doctor that is reinforcing it is really going to make a difference. We have a really important voice as doctors, as health professionals.
And we're giving our patients choices. We're not telling them you have to do this or that. But by spreading the knowledge, it's much easier to make a choice that's good for us. So I 100% back that up. And I'm wondering where we are 10 years from now when we talk about ultra-processed foods. I think we will talk about it in a much different way than we do right now.
Yeah, I think there needs to be some guidelines, and hopefully we'll talk about it in the way that we talk about alcohol. Like, oh, okay, it's I think already it's not meant to be for under twos, but you know, if for children we have certain guidelines that we stick to, and for adults that we know that okay, you can eat it if you want, and you know the risks, and that's fine. Yeah, the same we do with alcohol.
But it's not about shame at all, and it's not about, because I watched that debate. And what I was so frustrated with was that they took this piece of bread that was whole wheat bread, and then they took some, I don't know, something else that was ultra processed, maybe chips or something or candy. And they like tried to compare them because both were ultra processed. And that's not what we're saying. We're not saying that the ultra processed whole grain bread is as bad as a fizzy drink. But what we're trying to say is that if you have a bread that's ultra-processed, try to find the bread that's not ultra-processed. Try to find, if there is a choice, to find the not ultra-processed type.
Yeah, or if the only choice you have, because actually when you go into some of the food shops in Norway, they don't have normal bread anymore. Mm. They only have ultra-processed bread. Mm. But make that sandwich with the ultra-processed bread. But have some vegetables and fruit on the side. Have some nuts. Have a hot cooked egg. Don't have it then lots of very ultra-processed meats with it or other things. So try and balance it out. And I'm also not saying never eat ice cream again. You know, Sutton the Mai would not be the same.
I need my ice cream. Don't take that away from me.
Taking it away from you. But you probably, a week after Sutton the Mai, don't eat ice cream for a bit.
Yeah,
because you're going to balance it out.
Yeah,
and realizing that when you're having that part of your diet is made up of something ultra processed, you can be like, okay, well, I'll balance it with something else.
Yeah. Hmm. I like that. Okay, what's another pillar?
Yes, where are we up to? So physical activity.
That's interesting. I watched a lecture you had on physical activity, and I was amazed at looking at the numbers that you told. Like, how many percent do not have any physical activity at whatsoever?
Oh, I don't have that on top of my head.
Yeah, it was
it was scary.
It was
for
like
Europe,
30%
wasn't it?
Or something.
Yeah, no, it is a bit scary. And to put this the other way would be that the World Health Organization have identified physical inactivity, so not exercising, as the fourth leading risk factor for death. Cause mortality.
Oh, wow.
And that's scary, isn't it? Because we're not talking about bacteria, we're not talking about like a road accident, we're not talking about all these other things that we tend to be scared of in life and we must protect ourselves from. Mm. No, we're talking about just sitting down too much and not getting in our recommended daily allowance or weekly allowance of exercise. Noise, pretty good for children though. So for 6-year-olds, so for all children, it's recommended that they do 1 hour of exercise a day.
Okay.
And so 6-year-olds, it's between 85 and 95% of children do that.
Oh, great.
So in all these children's statistics, the lower number is unfortunately the girls versus the boys who tend to be more active. So for 9-year-olds, it's 65 to 80%. get their daily allowance. And for 15-year-olds, it really drops. It's 40 to 50%.
Oh, wow.
Are doing the what's recommended. What we know is the minimum recommended as well. Mm. So I think one of the first things I learned from doing extra training in lifestyle medicine was how to talk about exercise with patients. Mm. And learning what is the minimum recommendation and how to put that into something really tangible when talking to patients. Yeah. So it's recommended by the WHO and from the Lifestyle Medicine Council that it's 150 minutes of moderate intensity training a week, mm. and in addition to strength training practices in a week. And I think what's really important is the word moderate, and what does that mean? Mm. And so the way I explain it to my patients is that we have three levels of intensity: low, medium, and high. So if we were on a walk together, Annetta, and we were chatting away, and I said, oh, shall we sing some of our favorite Disney songs, and we could manage to sing them, then that would be low intensity because we had enough breath to sing.
Yeah.
Okay. So medium intensity is when we're perhaps going up a little bit of a hill. Luckily in Norway you've got quite a few hills to walk up, and we try and sing some songs, but we're like, no, haven't quite got enough some breath, we'll just talk. That's medium intensity. So you're not quite as
talkative,
that's the word. And then high intensity is when we're trying to chat, but actually we're going up something really steep, or we're carrying something really heavy, or we're going with a bit of tempo, and we can't manage to even talk in whole sentences. Mm. So that's just a really easy way to work out, are you doing enough moderate intensity training? So 150 minutes, moderate intensity training every week, and two strength training sessions.
How long do they have to take?
It doesn't say, actually. Mm. And I think doing anything is better than nothing.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'd always say. But in Norway, they've been looking at how well adults are achieving their recommended physical activity. Actually, in Norway, I'm pretty sure when I first got here and I looked at the recommendations, it was including the two strength training sessions, but now it doesn't, so I don't know when that's changed. But actually, you guys are doing pretty well. 75% manage 150 minutes of moderate intensity training.
That's great.
I think that's amazing. But what the Norwegian state has decided, or what we know from research, is that if you have a job or a lifestyle where you're sitting down a lot, so for over 8 hours a day, we need to increase that training, because we now know that sitting still is like the new smoking.
But how does sitting still affect us?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have all the science behind me, but we do know that it is an independent risk factor. So if you train every evening but you sit down for the most part of the day, you are more risk of being unwell. Yeah. But it can be combated. So actually a lot of the research is showing that by just moving around 2 minutes every 20 minutes or 5 minutes in an hour is enough to combat that sit in the job. So, but what the Norwegian recommendation is that if you sit down for more than 8 hours a day, then you need to try and hit 300 minutes of moderate intensity training in a week. And unfortunately, only 30% of Norwegian adults get that.
Because I, like most people in Norway, we have work that we have to sit a lot.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. It's because we're sitting right now.
We are sitting.
I have heard about one podcast that Anja Ammerseng-Edin's podcast, Heart Mentality. She's walking on the treadmill when she's talking. Yeah. I love that.
But just standing up actually has, that would be enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we could have a standing pult, what do you call that? Like a
really?
Bench, a desk.
I should get like a desk that can
We could do that.
Be heightened.
or for me, for example, I have patients 20 or 30 minutes at a time, and I get up and I just go and get a glass of water, or I just go and say hi to my colleagues, and I just walk around and stretch a little bit for 30 seconds, a minute, as often as I can.
Yeah, I can feel like all these pillars, we're better at some of them than others. And exercise has been one of the pillars that I like. When I get advices on that, I like feel like my chest tightens. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. I get those minutes that are recommended, but it's not as easy for me as it is with food and sleep. Like that's easy. It's totally ingrained in my life. But with the exercise, I have found that I'm just trying to help with people who feel the same way, that for me, it's better, for example, walking with a friend. That helps me immensely than going by myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I do like some interval trainings with a friend of mine that takes 25 minutes, but it's high intensity training, and that takes down the minutes you have to exercise every week. And that helps me. So like, I have to find something that I like. If not, I'm not going to be able to meet the recommendations.
Yeah, no, it's so important. And I always, people ask me, what's the best training to do? And I say, the best training is the one that you like doing, you're actually going to do.
Yeah.
If it's not fun, then you're not going to keep doing it. And the whole idea of lifestyle medicine is we're creating positive habits that you're going to be able to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So if you're, January has just been and everyone's like, oh, I'm going to go to the gym 3 times a week and run 10K and I'm going to lift all these weights. And if that's what you love doing, great, you'll probably do it. Mm. But I don't do that.
Yeah.
That's difficult. But if you just say, okay, I'm going to go for a walk, I'm just going to move my body more, that is better than not moving your body. So start with the first step, which should just be something really realistic, something really low threshold that you know you can do and that you enjoy doing. Listen to a podcast whilst you're all going for a walk. Go for it with a friend, walk the dog, all these things. I don't think it has to be seen as exercise where you have to be sweating in a gym or pushing up lots of weights in the air. It can be doing 5 squats whilst you're waiting for the coffee machine to go in the morning.
Yeah, those small things.
Small things.
And just taking the stairs instead of the elevator. Like my grandfather, he turned 96 before he fell away, and he never did anything that you could call exercise, at least not the last 60 years of his life. But he was like active. He walked the stairs always. He walked to the city to take a coffee with his friends, and those small things, you wouldn't think that was exercise, but that was really good exercise for him because he was in movement.
Yeah, and I think it's important to just reiterate that the pillar is called physical activity, not exercise.
Yeah.
So it is about movement. It's about enjoying what you're doing. And I think dancing with your kids in the kitchen whilst you're making dinner counts.
Yeah.
Do that, but do something.
Yeah, do those small things that help.
And
I like to think about it that the reason that I managed to do it, because I have resistance in me doing a lot of exercise, but the reason why I managed to do it is because I have the knowledge behind. And every time I move or walk the stairs, I think about like my lymphatic system working better. Like I picture it in my head that we know that our blood vessels have muscles pumping the blood around, but our lymph system doesn't have that. We have to have movement.
We have to have movement
to get the immune system working properly and move everything around in the body. You can say it easily like that.
And also for mental health. I mean, we said already that these pillars always interconnect with each other, interact with each other. But I think there was a really big article that came out, a meta-analysis, so looking at all the data and putting it into like trying to summarize it into one, that came out last year in the British Medical Journal, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And it was saying that just how important mental exercise is for mental health. It is the best thing you can do to improve your mental health is moving. Any type of exercise. So it wasn't even like, oh, it has to be high intensity or it has to be this, it has to be that. They found that any amount of movement you did improved your mental health. Now, the problem is you don't feel like doing it. Like we said, when you're feeling ill, you don't want to eat well. When you're feeling ill, you don't want to move. So that's why we have to really remind patients that's our job. Is how we're going to get them better. But also baking it into their everyday, because people who do exercise regularly are fitter, are healthier. They don't have as many problems with mental health or with chronic diseases, and their knees don't hurt as much and their back doesn't hurt as much and they sleep better, and it just goes on. So it's very important, and I don't want to scare people off by people thinking they have to suddenly get a gym membership and start throwing around lots of really heavy weights. But movement is so key.
Yeah. I love how you explain that. What is do we have one or two last pillars?
So we've got two. We've got healthy relationships.
Yeah.
And then minimizing substance.
Let's go through them.
Okay. So healthy relationships. Another way of calling it would be connectedness.
Mm.
And this is the feeling where you feel like you belong. You have support and care that you need and positive relationships around you that build you up. And actually, this has become so important and really being talked about quite recently. For example, the WHO, World Health Organization, commissioned a new commission last year in November 2023, because they have seen the research and showing that people who have healthy relationships in their life, they are more likely to live longer and not die than people who don't.
Isn't that amazing?
And like, I try and get the statistic out there, but it was quite difficult for me to say without confusing myself. But it's like strong social bonds improve our chances of not dying young by 50%.
Can you imagine?
It's like crazy.
Yeah.
And so the CDC in America are talking about it, and we have the research that shows that if you have healthy relationships, you meet people on a regular basis, you're not socially isolated, you feel that you belong to a club or a team or a group of people, mm-hmm. you're more likely to get better from other diseases quicker, including lung disease, like lung betelsa.
Pneumonia.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we would always think, oh, that's bacteria, you need antibiotics. Yeah. But actually improving, getting better, and wellness is so to do with social relationships.
Oh, wow.
So it improves, you reduce your risk of cardiac disease, heart problems. You reduce your risk of getting obese and depression. And they've actually, some research has put a percent on what is loneliness. So they've worked out what is loneliness now.
Okay.
So they reckon that if you are alone for 70% of the time, then or more, that is when you are statistically awesome. We can give a definition that is loneliness now.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what that is in Norway. Mm-hmm. I'm not, unfortunately, not in the Norwegian culture enough to really understand the problems of maybe old age and not having enough social contacts.
Yeah.
I know from my experience, I know that Barnehage is very good and the school system is very good at creating these positive relationships.
Yeah.
But I wonder maybe it's more difficult when you're older.
Yeah. Oh, I get a lump in my throat when you say that, because I was just with my grandmother at Voss this winter vacation, and she sent me this message yesterday saying that she loved having us there. And we're a lot, because we were five people coming. My mother came from the north, but she said, oh, I miss you guys. It's so empty here without you.
Yeah.
And it is that the relationships are so important. And it just reminds me to, like, check in with my grandmother or my friends. Like, taking care of your relationships, it's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So, how do we reduce that? It's establishing, finding people who like the same things, that want to do the same activities as you, and then maintaining that relationship. You've got to put a little bit of work into it.
Yeah.
But these are going to have a really positive effect on your health.
Mm. Do you know how much time we need with a person?
No, I don't think I have any statistics or data on the top of my head. Mm. But I know that for me, it's really important. I'm a really social creature. I would spend time with everybody the whole time.
Yeah.
And I have to remind myself not everybody is as extroverted as I am. And other people need some time on their own.
Yeah.
Whereas I literally, not, it doesn't have to be a party, but I just love being with people. That really gives me energy.
Oh. Mm. Yeah, so we are different there, but still, if you're an introvert, we know from science it's very healthy and good for you.
Yeah.
To be out with people.
Yeah, it's really
But
important.
Maybe not a party.
Maybe not a party.
Yeah.
But also volunteering. That's really healthy.
Yeah.
And really good. And there's some really good data on that coming out, especially Loma Linda University in America.
Yeah.
There is a religious university. And so volunteering is a really big part of what they believe in.
Mm.
But I've actually seen that it really helps you have a healthy lifestyle and reward that you get from helping other people, it helps us.
Yeah. So by helping other people, yeah. You're helping yourself.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
I love that. So what do you recommend, like how to get better relationships?
I think that's a bit difficult for me to come into Norway and not being Norwegian to know how that the best way to do that is. Mm. I know what I do. I throw myself into making new friends. I go and like actively knock on doors and be like, hi.
Do you want to be my friend?
Do you want to be my friend?
Do you want to take my aerobics class? I understood that you have that.
Yeah, I think all the ladies in Haslam are going to be laughing because they'll really recognize that.
Like, you have to join my aerobics class or else. We need to be friends.
Yeah, but what I was also actually taking part in the other day for the first time, which was really fun, was I was at a Langrenn.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness. It was the most Norwegian thing I've ever been to.
Yeah.
So my middle child was taking part in this Langrenn race. And I just love the atmosphere there. And I just thought all these people are giving up their time to come and help the kids do the sport that they think is fun and to organize the race, but also all the cake sale and the coffee and the pulsalumpa and everything. But it was a great atmosphere. And I just thought, yeah, this is probably, you know, if I'd grown up in Norway, maybe this is what I would have been doing. I mean, I was doing completely other things in England growing up and what's culturally significant for me.
Yeah.
But I think that's also, you know, just giving a plug for the society again, the Forening that I've set up is that I need Norwegians. Like I'm English, I know that, and I need people who understand deep culturally about what Norwegians like to do and how they think so that we can set up this society that's relevant for Norway. Like I know what they're doing in England, I know how the lifestyle medicine is working around Europe and what they're trying out, but how are we going to make it for Norway? Yeah. Are we going to make it Norwegian? That's what I'm really excited to learn as well from people. Mm. And also have my own ideas from having three kids that are growing up in society here. But I'm not an expert, unfortunately.
No, but you will know if you found your tribe. Like you only need one person there. But having this one person has such a huge effect on your health because you know if there's anything that happened to you, that person would be there.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that person, take the steps towards that because there's always this other person that would love to be your friend and have the same, maybe different kinds of interest that you do.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I can, like, just once by starting this podcast, I've gotten so many close friends that because we believe in the same things. And it's been so, it's been such a privilege to be able to interview so many people that are talking about this as we are. So what is the last?
Yes. So the last one is minimizing harmful substances or behaviors. And this is maybe a bit more what we're talking about in a normal regular GP. Office actually because we know alcohol in large amounts is not good for us and we know smoking isn't good for us and drugs, but actually lifestyle medicine is trying to look at other behaviors, so social media, gambling, doing things that you know aren't healthy or helpful for yourself. So maybe binge eating or getting sugar cravings might also come into that, because often why we're doing it is what we're not talking about, but is actually really important. So why are we doing it? And then how can we take away the harmful, ineffective mechanisms that we have in place already with alcohol or social media or whatever, and replacing it and finding a healthier, more effective way to help whatever bad feeling you've got? Is it anxiety? Is it stress? Is it that you can't sleep or worry? What is it that you're, why are you using this harmful substance?
Oh, that's very good that you mentioned, because I think that is more normal than we think to find something that numb our feelings, because a lot of people, and myself included before, have feelings that they try to like
dampen down.
Yeah, dampen with something. And for me, it was just working hard as a student and exercising really hard, like trying to find something that just took away those hard feelings that was on the inside. So try to find what is it that you are trying to use to dampen those feelings, and why don't you want to look at them?
Yeah.
Because by looking at them, they will get less scary, and with time, your life quality will get so much better. But it's hard work, and it's scary to look at them.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the lifestyle medicine approach is to be non-judgmental.
Yeah.
And to just approach this as, you know, with love and care, and to hopefully have places that we can signpost you to get the help that you need, and to help build up those better habits that will help in the future.
Yeah. I love that you say that lifestyle medicine is non-judgmental, because it's so important, because every person on this planet is trying their best. And by spreading the knowledge, it's easier to do what's good for us.
Yeah.
So it's not pointing fingers, no. It's just spreading the knowledge, and everyone has the choice then to do what's best for them.
Yeah, and I think we go back to this like non-blame culture, that we've not like thought, oh, let's have lifestyle medicine so we can point at everyone's bad habits. But it's just more using the data that we have, and also acknowledging that some people are dealt a bad hand and they have genetic potential, which means they're more at risk. I was looking at research about health outcomes and what builds up how healthy we are. So I think it was 5% is the environment that we live in.
Yeah.
So do you live in a city? Do you live in a town? 10% is the medical care that you receive. So perhaps in some countries you need insurance to get medical care.
Yeah.
Or you can't afford medical care. 15% is the social circumstances. So have you got a lot of money? Have you got good education? 30% is genetics and epigenetics. And I think it's important talking about genetics that we understand that it does influence and have a potential, but also we have the potential to not turn on those genes.
Yeah, epigenetics is very important. So although it says 30%, you can't change how those genes are read.
Yes, exactly. But that leaves 40%. 40% is lifestyle. And so I feel like it's my job as a doctor to help patients understand how they can help improve their own health environment. And I'm not saying we have to touch on all the six pillars all at the same time or change everything, but normally by making one small change, we really are going to make a difference for the future.
Yeah. It's been so great talking to you, Charlotte. What you're trying to do here in Norway and starting the Norske Forening for Livsstilsmedisin is so important, and it's I know that it's been a lot of work, but I'm so grateful that you do that work, because I think that many people together, we will be able to change this boat that's going in the wrong direction. We need to change it, not just for us, but for our children's sake, because we are going in the wrong direction regarding our health right now.
Yeah.
So I'm very, very grateful for your work, and I'm very happy to spread your knowledge here in my podcast. For the medical doctors listening to, how can they become a member of the new Forening?
Yeah, so I launched the website last week, and it's nflm.no.
Norsk Forening Livsstilsmedisin, nflm.no.
And also we have a Facebook page and an Instagram page and LinkedIn.
I will post everything in episode info.
Yeah, perfect. And the idea is with the Forening is that we need to spread the word. So we have three aims. So the first aim is to be a network for people so we can learn from each other, we can share knowledge, we can look at research together and then work out how we're going to implement that in Norway. Yeah. How are we going to use this in a really tangible way that isn't taking up 100% of our time or integrating it into our everyday? Mm. We also want to help people train. I got an immense amount of information and felt like I really learned so much by doing the diploma in lifestyle medicine, but not everyone needs to do that. Maybe you just need to learn a bit about exercise or nutrition just to help do your job better or to improve it. And then the third is to help influence society, which is a little aim. but we need to spread the word, and we need patients to really understand that to be healthier and to have wellness, we need to be doing these habits. So those are the three aims. And I'm not the only doctor that's doing this at the moment. You know, there are lots of doctors that I've already spoken to that are already using lifestyle medicine, whether they knew that's what it was or not. But yeah, using those six pillars or a version of those six pillars in their work. And so I'm just really excited to hear from doctors that are already doing it and to how we can work together or share that information and knowledge. Mm-hmm. But also if you're listening to this and you're like, this is how I want to work, this is how I want to feel like I'm being rewarded by treating my patients and not just upping their medication every time, but actually giving them tools so they can improve their own health environment, please get in touch, because I love talking about this.
Yeah, I know you do. We could talk for hours about it. And could you please tell, because you mentioned before we started recording that in Lithuania, they actually have medical doctors in every...
Yes. So what's really exciting about the European Lifestyle Medicine Council is that we have a person from all the countries in Europe that have a lifestyle medicine society already. Mm. And then we get to hear what they're doing. And it is very culturally different. You know, what we're going to do in Norway will be different to what we do in Lithuania. But what they have just decided now is that every doctor's office, every fastlege kontor, is going to have somebody who is trained in lifestyle medicine to help support the GPs.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that be amazing? And like when you hear what they're doing in Portugal or in Poland, in England, like England, they're doing group consultations to help patients tackle their chronic diseases, because learning from each other is actually a really powerful way to learn and to improve your health. So I think what's really exciting is we don't know how we're going to use this in Norway, and I don't know. And I'm just waiting to build this out with everybody else and see where it leads. But I'm 100% positive that it will lead to a healthier society by using the knowledge that we have. We can't ignore
absolutely.
It anymore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have seen it on our patients so many times. But thank you so much, Charlotte, for joining me today. Where can my listeners find you?
Yeah, so I work as a doctor, as a GP, and I'm overlegger for livsstilsmedicine at CRI. And I'm really passionate about prevention and using lifestyle medicine to help people lose weight or to help stay healthy and improve people's wellness.
Are you on Instagram?
No, I'm not.
Most of my guests are not.
No,
so
I'm not. But but come and see me in the office, or take get in touch with Kri if you'd like to get in touch.
Yeah, or you could just if you have any questions for this episode, just write under on Instagram on this episode. And if you want to find me, you can find me at Dr. Anette Dragland on Instagram, Facebook, and now I'm on YouTube. And is there anything else you want to share while you're here, Charlotte?
I think when people are asking me about what they should do to be healthier, it starts with one habit that makes your day go round. And for me, that's exercise. I have to be really active in the week. And that makes me sleep better, makes me eat better. I'm a better wife, colleague, and mother for doing that. So my challenge would be to find what is your key habit. And it's probably within those six pillars.
Yeah.
And start with that. And you won't go wrong.
I love that. Mm. Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
And if you think that this episode is... something you want to share, so share it. That's how we spread the knowledge. And if you want to subscribe, you can subscribe on Apple and Spotify on Lägger om livet plus, and also on YouTube. And that's all for today. Have a great day. Bye.